This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Remember those big storms that left many of us in the dark for days, even weeks last year? We all went scrambling to power up our computers, to recharge our smartphones, and to grab a bite to eat in a well-lit restaurant. The dark just didn't feel quite right to us. But maybe a little bit more dark is what we need. UConn researcher Richard Stevens is a cancer epidemiologist at UConn Medical Center. He studies the impact of artificial light on our health. He joined us on Where We Live 5 years ago to talk about his research in the causes of a rise in breast cancer rates.
Beginning, about 20 years ago, we started thinking about what else changes with industrialization. Lighting changes, people doing shift work, people not getting enough, maybe enough dark.
Now people are paying close attention to this work. The American Medical Association just called for more study into the possible link between artificial light and a higher risk for cancer, obesity, and other conditions. There's also a new study from Ohio State University researchers who found that hamsters chronically exposed to light at night showed signs of depression within a few weeks. Today, Where We Live will try to get out of the dark about the dangers of artificial light, from overhead fluorescence to reading your iPad right before bed. A look at what all this light is doing to our sleep and to our health. Do you stay up late at night to watch TV or surf the web? Are you a night shift worker or a night owl? Give us a call, 860-275-7266. 860-275-7266. You can email us where we live at wnpr.org or you can tweet us at where we live. Our first guest is Dr. Richard Stevens, again, from the Division of Epidemiology and Biostatistics and the University of Connecticut Health Center. Good to see you once again, Doctor. Thank you for being here.
Oh, thank you, John. It's very good to be here.
So the first thing I have to ask is, what has changed in the 5 years since we had this conversation about light and its possible effects on health, and especially some of the cancer research that you do?
Well, I think there's two things. One is the epidemiologic studies have continued to move forward. A couple of more very strong studies have sort of confirmed that shift working women seem to be at higher risk. And then the very exciting part to me is the basic science. We know now that even ordinary room light in the evening can delay melatonin onset and blunt its rhythm at night. We didn't know that 5 years ago.
Melatonin onset. Explain exactly what that means.
Well, melatonin is a marker of circadian rhythmicity. And it put any of us in a cave with absolutely no light cue, no light, no time cues, and we will have a 24-hour rhythm, about 24 hours for the rest of our lives. One of those rhythms is in melatonin. It goes up during the night and is low during the day.
So when you are exposed to artificial light at a time when you're not supposed to be, what happens to your melatonin?
It goes down immediately. You do need dark for melatonin and a good circadian rhythm, but you do not need sleep. You can wake up in the middle of the night. If you stay in the dark, your melatonin will be just fine. Turn on even a relatively dim light, certainly those lights in the bathroom, that will start suppressing melatonin immediately. We know that. There's no question about that.
So we're talking about any light. We're not talking about dim light, the type of reading light you might have next to your bedside, maybe even candlelight. All artificial light is doing the same thing to you.
No, not necessarily. It depends on the intensity and the wavelength. And this is the important part for the next 5 years. Five or so years. We didn't think light affected melatonin in humans at all up until 1980, and there was a paper published in Science, a very prestigious journal, but it was very bright light, and that amount of light that can lower melatonin has been coming down, down, down. But we don't know about the very dim lights from maybe an iPad in the evening. We don't know the extent to which that lowers melatonin. That's important to find out.
We're talking with Richard Stevens at the University of Connecticut Health Center. We're talking about artificial light on the program today in many facets. We'll be talking about fluorescent lights, the new kind that we use, those little curly Q lights, and whether or not those have some sort of health effect on us. We're also going to be talking about the night sky as well. If you want to join us, 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266. Of course, we were fascinated by this research into night shift workers and the possibility of links to breast cancer. I mentioned this Ohio State University study. What are some of the things that are out there right now? It seems as though there must be so much more research into this because artificial light has become even more a part of our lives in just the last 5 years.
Well, artificial light is a huge environmental issue, and it is now finally becoming seen to be so. I focused on breast cancer, of course, but the basic science on the effect of light on circadian rhythmicity really does implicate obesity, diabetes, and I think very importantly, depression and affective disorders.
And how does it do that? How does it work to depress us?
We don't know exactly. The work on obesity and diabetes comes from actually human volunteers in a sleep laboratory where sleep is disrupted. But at the same time you're disrupting sleep, of course, you're disrupting circadian rhythmicity. And this leads to a decrease in leptin, one of the hunger hormones, which raises hunger, actually. And then also these same series of studies have shown that this sleep disruption, which is also circadian disruption, pushes young people to a pre-diabetic state. Their glucose tolerance is impaired significantly. The depression part goes back a long way, with seasonal affective disorder was the first entry into this. It seems to be a disease, if you will, of circadian maladjustment.
Well, let's talk about this link between sleep and circadian rhythms, because I want to make sure I have this straight. You're talking about circadian rhythms being disrupted by artificial light at night, also disrupting sleep. Maybe the two are linked. In some ways, they're not linked. Maybe explain how sleep plays into all this and whether or not we're getting enough sleep as a people as well.
Sleep is very important. And it is, I think, the general consensus now that Americans and people in modern societies are not getting enough. We need it for cognitive ability, adjustment to life. It's part of the circadian rhythmicity, but it's not exactly the same thing. You can sleep in the middle of the day if you're sleepy enough, even though that's not the circadian time. In addition, as I mentioned before, in the middle of the night, if you wake up and stay in the dark, your circadian rhythm is fine. So the two are very much related, but they're not the same thing.
If you sleep in the middle of the day, does it harm you?
Oh, I don't.
From a circadian standpoint?
I do not think so. I can't see how it would. But again, what we need for our circadian rhythmicity specifically is a bright day and a dark night. And we're not getting either in the modern world, actually. We don't get the sun. People are not getting the sun as much as they're getting too much light during the night.
Well, okay, so we spent millions of years evolving into this particular type of human that we are right now. And we were lit by sunlight most of the time, and we were in the dark at night. We've had a pretty long time to adjust to this. Are humans adjusting to this? Are we moving to a place at which maybe artificial light, a different circadian rhythm, is just going to be part of the human species condition?
Oh, it will select. It will make selection for us. But it's not only a few million, it's 3 billion years that life has adapted to this solar day. And in fact, it's a very deep molecular genetic mechanism that allows us to anticipate the sun. As I mentioned, if you're in the complete dark, you have approximately a 24-hour rhythm, which is endogenous. It's genetically determined. But it's not exactly. We need a system, and we've evolved it, to detect the sun to tell us that it is day. And in the modern world, that's all getting malaligned. I want to use appropriate words. So yeah, we'll adapt. But at the process, if we take another few hundred thousand years. But in the process, there's going to be a lot of ill health as a result of it.
You know, it's funny, when we just sat down, just before we started the program, you said that you're a bit jet-lagged. You just came off a trip.
Yeah, I took the red eye on Wednesday night, so I actually had to use an alarm clock, and it took me out of a deep sleep at 6:30 in the morning. I'm always up at 6:30 in the morning, but not today.
Hold it. So what does someone like you, who understands circadian rhythms and understands the problems with artificial light, what do you do on a red eye? I mean, do you try to block out all light? Do you not sleep? Do you stay up? What do you do?
I just try to get through the plane ride. I find it very stressful. But, you know, we're not going to give up electric light. I'm not advocating anything of the sort. It's more intelligent use of light, because it does disrupt our circadian rhythms depending on how much of it, what wavelength, blue versus red, important aspect of it. So it's more intelligent use. I'm not giving up electricity myself.
Intelligent use of light, and we'll get to that in a moment. 860-275-7266 if you want to join us by phone. 860-275-7266. We've got a call from Vion who couldn't stay on the line from Norwich, who says works the third shift and wants to say that he tries to work as much in darkness as possible in order to offset the dark. That's interesting. I'm not exactly sure what that means. Can you offset the amount of light you have by spending more time in the dark at various times of the day?
Well, this is kind of an extreme and very important example, is people who work non-day shifts.
Yes.
And that's 20% of the population now in the modern world. And we can do a better job of lighting those shifts, because we sort of have to balance the safety and quality of the work of the person with their circadian health, a better job can be done. And the LED technologies are offering that possibility. There's a lot of research going on that. And in fact, some limited actual use of this technology. The Boeing Dreamliner 787, the lighting for that plane is LED. It was designed specifically to do a better job of helping people adapt to the new time zone. And they advertise that. It actually changes wavelength and intensity over the span of the flight.
So the actual quality of the light, the type of light we're using, can really help us in a way, to help to cope with some of these problems.
Yes, it can.
When you talk about blue light versus red light, how do I know if I'm getting blue light or red light?
Well, that's a big topic, incandescent bulbs versus fluorescent. It's actually a bit of a controversy now because although incandescent bulbs are much less energy efficient, they also, in the evening, are probably a little bit better for your circadian health. They're stronger in the red than in the blue. A good fluorescent light is very blue. So during the day, that's great.
Okay.
In the night, it's not so great.
I want to bring into the conversation someone who's been looking at fluorescent lights. And if you want to join us, 860-275-7266. Dr. Mirjan Rafailovic is a distinguished professor of materials and science engineering at Stony Brook University, who joins us by phone here. Doctor, thank you so much for being on Where We Live. I appreciate your time.
Hi. Yes.
I was just talking with Dr. Stevens about the quality of different types of light, red light versus blue light. I know that what you've been studying is these compact fluorescents, the light bulbs that we have essentially been told we really should buy because they're very, very energy efficient. What do they do to our health, do you think?
I can't really comment on the circadian rhythms about them because spectra, as you probably know, their spectrum is not as broad as that of the incandescent light bulbs. The light is the fluorescent, depends on the phosphor, and it's got discrete lines. It radiates in discrete lines of light. But when you talk about health, what we had done research on was something completely different. The compact fluorescent light and all fluorescent light bulbs have the potential of leaking ultraviolet rays. And if the phosphor is in any way damaged, so it doesn't absorb the UV rays that are generated inside the bulb, then they can leak UVC, UVA, and some UVB. So the amount of leakage that we found was a lot greater in the compact fluorescent light bulbs than in the regular light like you have in office buildings.
Hold it. How does it leak UV rays? Does it do that naturally or only when the bulb is damaged?
Only when the bulb is damaged. In principle, it should be minimal. It's not zero. There is leakage of UV light from all bulbs, but it's less than the quantity called TLV, which is the total amount that you're allowed over an eight-hour period. So most bulbs have some UV, but it's completely within the amount that we're able to tolerate. The problem comes in when these bulbs are damaged. And the compact fluorescent bulbs tend to be damaged a lot more than the regular fluorescent lighting.
Dr. Stevens, what do you know about this? This is an interesting idea. The doctor's saying not only do all bulbs give off a little bit of UV radiation, but also these compact fluorescents, when damaged, can give off a lot more, it seems. What do you know about this, Dr. Stevens?
Well, everything's related to everything, but one point that was just made is that the fluorescent bulbs have spikes. They don't actually have full spectrum. They have spikes at different wavelengths. Now, that's important to the circadian part. The other part about UV, of course, is skin damage and the potential for DNA mutations. And I think that's interesting and important, but it's not directly related to, as I understand it, to the circadian aspect of it.
Not related to the circadian aspect of it, but as a cancer epidemiologist, you probably don't like the idea of any artificial light giving off UV radiation, right?
Well, as they say in Alabama, that can't be good.
Yeah. Well, I certainly understand this. So what else do we know about this? Dr. Rafailovic, before I let you go, how much more work has to be done on this? It seems as though the American public has been told that these types of compact fluorescent bulbs are very, very good for energy efficiency. We've been asked to go out and buy them. Do you think that there is some sort of long-term damage to us all having them in our homes?
There could be long-term damage if they're not used properly, and that's where the problem comes in. If they're used in, for example, desk lamps, or the worst are these desk gooseneck lamps where you can actually look directly into them. Your eyes are more prone to UV damage than your skin, especially UVC. And people using them for when they're working with their hands or like doing a puzzle or any kind of craft, then you can really come in very close to the bulb and get a UV burn. That's where the danger comes in. It's not very high technology to fix this, I think, because from all the bulbs that we tested, the one that had the most minimal amount was actually something called a party bulb. It was bright red for parties. And when we looked at it, it seemed that the bright red color came from some kind of rubbery material. So when the fluorescent, fluorophores were encased in this soft rubbery material, they were less prone to crack. So I think it's there's a fix that could be accomplished without that much effort by industry.
I'm going to go out and get a party bulb for the nightstand. I have one of these bulbs just a few feet from my face every single night. Dr. Miriam Rafailovich from Stony Brook University, thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate your time.
You're welcome. Thank you.
When we come back, we're going to continue our conversation with Dr. Richard Stevens and take some of your phone calls at 860-275-7266. We're also going to be talking with Leo Smith, the Northeast Regional Director for the International Dark Sky Association, as we talk about artificial light, how it may be damaging us in several ways. You can email us wherewelive@wnpr.org, or you can tweet us at wherewelive. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. I hope you can join me tonight in Goshen for the start of the Litchfield Jazz Festival. I'll be there helping them do an auction to benefit their jazz camps. There's going to be a night full of swing music tonight and a whole weekend full of jazz. You can find out more at litchfieldjazzfest.com. Today in the program, we're talking about artificial light. We've spoken with Dr. Richard Stevens before from the University of Connecticut Health Center. He's done some groundbreaking research into the possibilities of artificial light damaging our bodies in several ways. And we're talking about this with a few experts and also with you at 860-275-7266, 860-275-7266. I want to get to Beth quickly in West Hartford. Hi there, Beth. Go ahead. You're on Where We Live.
Hi, John. Thanks for taking a call.
Yeah, what's up?
I also study mood disruptions, and one of the things that I look at is postpartum depression, which is a pretty normative experience for about, well, at least 10% of our population, but in lesser forms, maybe as many as 70% of people experience sort of what we call the baby blues. And I'm curious if Dr. Stevens might speculate with me about what we're seeing with the sleep disruptions that also are very normative when we bring newborns home. Are there perhaps things that these new parents are doing with their babies that are really disrupting their circadian rhythms and perhaps then setting their young children on paths to struggle, to learn how to fall into that diurnal rhythm that parents crave?
Beth, thank you very much. Great question. Dr. Stevens?
Oh, this is a very important area. And circadian rhythmicity is not really well formed, as any parent knows, when a baby is born. And the more we can do to help that, the better. And I've thought about this. I'm reluctant to make recommendations, but I really feel strongly about this. For newborn children, if you can keep it as dark as possible, you have to get up in the middle of the night to take care of them. Have a dim red light in the room. And I'm actually serious. If you turn on those bright lights, it not only makes it a lot tougher for you to get to sleep, it also is not helping that infant establish a consolidated, what we call consolidated circadian rhythmicity.
So a soft red light that's on that allows you to see and go do what you need to do and get the baby back to bed and things hopefully will be better.
You've got to have safety and you've got to be able to do your job, but a dim red light can do that.
I hear those party lights are great. You have to turn them on very soft.
I don't want the UVC. Listen,
Zach's in Torrington. Hi, Zach. Go ahead.
Hi, I wanted to know a little bit more about the candlelight or just in general fire. Since it's been around for so long, I'm curious to know what's the impact in relation to that.
Great question, Zach.
That's very good. Yeah, so 3 billion years we've had this light and dark, and then we discovered fire, I don't know how long ago, a few hundred thousand years ago, and then candles about 5,000 years ago. Up until the electric light bulb, however, and we had the moon, of course, as well, these are quite dim sources which are much more toward the yellow and red spectrum. So the disruption of the circadian rhythm is pretty minimal, I think. We also didn't do candles and all night.
Well, as we talk about our long, long history with the dark before we discovered fire, I want to bring in Leo Smith, Northeast Regional Director for the International Dark Sky Association. Leo, welcome to the show. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you, John.
So, first of all, I want to know how this entire conversation strikes you. Obviously, as you advocate for a darker sky, a darker night, I'm quite sure that a lot of what Dr. Stevens and other researchers are working on sort of sounds pretty good to you.
Actually, the focus of the International Dark Sky Association started with astronomy back in 1988 and has expanded into many other fields such as human health and bird migration and a number of other fields that that show that light at night has a dramatic effect not just on stars and stargazing but on a lot of other fields as well.
So obviously for astronomers, it makes perfect sense. You need a dark sky in order to be able to see the stars. But what does it do to our environment? What does it do to the critters in the woods?
It completely disrupts their, let's say, feeding cycles. With sea turtles, for example, they're drawn to light so that they may actually migrate towards a building rather than towards the sea. Birds, the Audubon Society is very concerned about light at night because when you have artificial light, birds use starlight to migrate at night. And when you have a situation oftentimes with a high-rise building that's lit in a fog, you'll have situations develop where birds will fly around and around and around the building until they die of exhaustion. And there are millions and millions and millions of birds that die every year from light at night.
What do you know about the types of light that we put out into the night sky? If as Dr. Stevens was saying earlier, there are certain types of light, frequencies of light that may be better for us, understanding that we live in a world in which we are going to light up the world at night, are there different ways we can do it better?
Yes, we can. One way is to use low-pressure sodium lamps, and they do that, for example, in San Diego, where they have an observatory. The street lights are all low-pressure sodium. And also, using more judiciously the light that we have, do we need a street light on all night long? Or would a street light serve its purpose, let's say, if it were turned off at midnight? So you have a lot of suburban settings where streets really are they're rolled up, the sidewalk rolls up at 10 o'clock. Do you really need that street light on all night long when really no one's using the road and there's no pedestrian traffic at all?
I think we've all had the experience, though, of driving late at night on a dark road with no lighting and it being a scary, potentially dangerous place, especially if it's raining or something like that. How has your organization balanced this obvious human need to have less ambient light at night with another obvious human need, which is human safety, making sure that we're not, you know, crashing into stuff in our cars?
Well, for example, the Merritt Parkway has no street lighting.
It does not.
and we also have situations like the Massachusetts Turnpike from the Boston Beltway out to the New York state line. It's no street lighting. And what they do there is you use good roadway markings, reflectors, other types of things that basically provide drivers with sufficient notice of where they are and where they need to be, so you don't need to have overhead lighting to provide safety.
I want you to join the conversation if you have thoughts about artificial light, whether it's in your workplace or at night in the night sky, 860-275-7266. Email us wherewelive at WNPR.org, or you can tweet us at where we live. Emily is in Berlin. Hi there, Emily. Go ahead. Hi, Emily. Go ahead. You're on the air. Perhaps Emily is gone. If you want to join us, 860-275-7266. We have a few questions coming in here for Dr. Stevens. Paul writes, what about children who sleep with a light on? Does that affect their health?
Well, I'm not sure. I don't know. It depends on, of course, it's going to depend on how bright it is. I would not have a nightlight for my child. And if you absolutely have to, a dim red one.
And if indeed you have to have something like that, can it be something that goes on and off at a certain period of time? What about lights that will click on and off at various times? If it's not consistent, does it still mess you up from a circadian standpoint?
Well, motion detectors would be good. This is, again, an area where we need a lot more work on how low intensity is going to disrupt circadian rhythms. If it's a dim red light, it's going to have a minimal effect. If it's a bright white light, it's going to suppress melatonin all night. And so there's something in the middle. But again, I think kids, I've had three, I think kids, if they do not expect the light at night, they aren't going to need it. So I think we habituate our children to the night light. A motion detector is another thing. I mean, a parent coming into the room needs a light right away. You could have a motion detector on a red light.
We've got another question here. What about people who live in Alaska, where part of the year the sun never rises, part of it never sets? I mean, there have been people living in parts of the world in which the circadian rhythms are much, much different for years and years and years. How does it affect them? What do we know about people who live near the North Pole?
Not a lot, because indigenous peoples are hard to study. But what we became very interested in breast cancer risk in far northern populations. And humans adapt. And what people have done in the far north is, during the winter, having fires and what they need for hunting and their lives. But during the summer, they get into an enclosure which is dark. So they don't quite have the total difference that you might think.
And Leo, one of the things that I guess, if our callers are interested in Alaska, I should ask about Connecticut. How do we do here when it comes to the night sky in our little corner of the world? Do we do a pretty good job of keeping it dark, or are we way too bright at night?
We're still way too bright at night, but the state legislature in Connecticut has done a wonderful job since 2001 in enacting legislation to try and reduce light pollution. In 2001, there was a law that required fully shielded streetlights. 2003, fully shielded utility lights. 2006, all state facilities were required to have fully shielded lighting. 2004, the state building code was amended to require all fully shielded lighting in parking lots and commercial applications. And in 2010, the Public Utility Control Commission adopted a regulation that required the utility company to put forth a new rate schedule for street lighting. Up until then, all street lighting had to be on from dusk to dawn. And now there's a new light regulation that says for rates that apply to streetlights that turn off at midnight, so towns can save money. And without that rate, they wouldn't be able to. So Connecticut has been at the forefront in making regulations and laws that will reduce light pollution. And there are still good places in Connecticut where you can see the stars.
And I want to talk about some of those places in just a moment. But when it comes to legislation, I guess I'm wondering if you found natural allies with the conservation movement that suggests that by not using as much energy, we will reduce our need for fossil fuels consumption, that we will indeed have a cleaner, healthier planet. How have you been working with the conservation movement in order to maybe achieve some of the same goals?
Energy conservation has been a big mover. In regards to taking a look at how we use light. We have some very natural allies like the Connecticut Audubon Society that work very closely with us on issues regarding light pollution. Dr. Richard Stevens was down at one of their meetings where they showed the film, The City Dark, that basically concentrates on the issues of light pollution and how it affects health and how it affects animals, stars, so forth. So there's a lot of alliance there.
So as we talk about legislation that's been passed to try to reduce the amount of light pollution, I guess I'm wondering how some of the work that you've done and others, Dr. Stevens, has moved us in a direction toward understanding a little bit more about whether it's light pollution or shift work, working at night. Are there some places in which we've made legislative strides, at least from your standpoint?
I don't focus on legislation. Leo Smith, that's why I was so glad he was going to be on the show, it's very important. Thus, scientist types tend to focus on our little scientific stuff and almost are afraid to get into the public policy domain. But, of course, we should. We should be doing it more and more.
So, for instance, many years ago now, laws were passed that said you can't smoke in restaurants, you can't smoke in most public places. And now we take it for granted. 20 years later, we just assume that nobody's going to be smoking in a restaurant because we realized it's bad for everyone's health. From your standpoint as an epidemiologist, might you be able to testify and say, look, we need to broadly change the way we light our workplaces at night because it is a human health risk?
Yes, I would be willing. And not only the workplace, but society in general. This issue of light pollution is as important an earth issue as global warming. That sounds like an extreme statement, but it really is, in part because it contributes to the fossil fuel burning. But also, it is disrupting a fundamental ancient aspect of our biology. Circadian biology was thought up until fairly recently to be a little odd sidelight in biology. It is now absolutely understood that it's at the center of biology for organisms, not just mammals, but insects and plants.
We're going to take some of your phone calls in just a moment at 860-275-7266. You can email wherewelive at WNPR.org or tweet us at wherewelive. Leo, you promised to tell us about some places that you can see the stars at night, places that do get dark here in Connecticut. Where are they?
For example, it's mostly in rural areas, but in Connecticut, there is a 22nd annual star party that's sponsored by the Astronomical Society of New Haven, and this year it's going to be held in Ashford. Last year it was held in Marlborough. So it's mostly either in some rural state parks or other rural areas that are distant from your urban lighting centers that provide the best view of the stars.
Are there any places that you can give away that you'd be willing to talk about on the radio that people can go see the stars?
Well, I went out to Utah this last May.
Is Utah. You hop on a plane and go to Utah. There's a lot of stars out there.
The darkest place in the United States.
And
I went there when there was no moon, and my wife was very kind in coming with me, and we spent the night sleeping under the stars, and it was magnificent. But you really have to get far, far away to really be able to see the beauty of what's out there. There was enough light coming from the stars with no moon to be able to see where the rocks were and where the car was and all of that. You could still see that just with starlight, and it's beautiful. But it takes a trip to be able to get to a place that is truly dark.
And it probably takes a trip to have people understand, frankly, what it is you're talking about. Because if you grew up in the Northeast and you lived here your entire life and you only saw a portion of the night sky and you always had that ring around the horizon of light coming off of New York City or Boston or Springfield or Hartford, you'd have to go to Utah or someplace very, very distant to actually understand what you're talking about, to soak in that thing that a few of us have gotten a chance to do. It is kind of magical, isn't it?
Oh, it is. When I was 19 years old and hitchhiking across the country, I found a place in Nevada. It was about maybe midnight, and it was rural. And the stars were so magnificent, I just rolled out my blanket, and I just laid there and watched the stars. It was just fantastic. But you do have to be someplace specially dark.
Yeah. If you want to join us and tell us your story about stargazing, 860-275-7266, or if you have questions for Richard Stevens about how artificial light may or may not affect your health, you can join us. You can also email us wherewelive at WNPR.org or tweet us at wherewelive. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today we're talking about artificial light. On Monday we're going to be talking about where that artificial light comes from. About half of Connecticut's electricity comes from nuclear power, and much of the rest of it is from natural gas, which for now is pretty cheap and pretty abundant. We'll hear from experts on energy sources in the state, and we'll check in with Germany. They're enlisting all of their nuclear power plants and they're eliminating all of their nuclear power plants and relying on wind and solar instead. Japan, of course, is in a nuclear dispute. We'll look at no nukes, more nukes. You can join the conversation coming up on the next where we live. I also invite you to join us on Tuesday night at the Red Rock Tavern at the corner of Broad and Capitol in downtown Hartford as we broadcast live for primary night in Connecticut. There are a few really important, very, very close races in the 5th Congressional District. We'll also be looking at the Senate race and some other races around the state. Colin McEnroe and a team of reporters from WMPR and the Connecticut Mirror will be joining us live all night from 7 to 10 p.m. You can join us on air. You can also join us in person at the Red Rock. Today we talk about artificial light and its effects on our health and our sleep and our life. Dr. Richard Stevens from the University of Connecticut Health Center, who we've talked with about light in the past, is here with us. Leo Smith is here from the International Dark Sky Association, and we're taking your calls at 860-275-7266. Let's go to Lisa in Naugatuck. Hi there, Lisa. Go ahead. You're on Where We Live.
Hi, yes. I just wanted to make a comment that it always seems that people forget about the off-shifters as far as our safety is concerned. For instance, I work second shift, part of second into third. And when I'm driving home on 84 and I'm going through the woods of Naugatuck at night to get home, I appreciate those street lights. I feel safer with those street lights. And the other comment I'd like to make is with the aging of society, people's eyesight's not quite what it used to be. And when they're driving at night, especially now when it gets darker earlier, they would appreciate more street lights, actually. They would feel safer driving. And so with the people around them.
Lisa, thank you very much. Dr. Stevens, so there's a shift worker who's making a case for a little bit more light for safety concerns and other reasons.
Well, this is the balance for shift work specifically, the balance between safety and quality of work on the job and long-term health due to circadian disruption. For lighting the streets, again, this is a policy issue. It's very important, and there needs to be a balance on that.
We want to take your phone calls here in a moment at 860-275-7266. But I want to bring into the conversation Dr. William Ehlers, who's an ophthalmologist at the University of Connecticut, to talk a bit more about the types of light that we use and how it may affect our world. Dr. Ehlers, thank you for joining us here on Where We Live.
Oh, thank you.
So one of the things I want to talk about is this idea of computer vision syndrome. I mean, it's not just the overhead lights or the lights next to our desks that we have to deal with now. An awful lot of our work, I know a lot of my work, deals with looking at screens all day, computer screens, iPads. I've got a few of them in front of me right now. How does all this affect your eyesight, your health, your sleep?
Well, that's an interesting question because it's not only where we live, it's when we live, and we live in the computer age. And computer vision syndrome, as it has been called, is a sort of a complex of really kind of common symptoms that people experience. There's the good news is computers don't hurt your eyes. The bad news is that computers are a visually intense activity. And when we are using a computer, we tend not to blink as often as we normally do. That contributes to dryness. If we use computers in an office or industrial-type environment, there may be other things like fluorescent lights, which some people find bothersome. The air quality may not be what we want it to be. If it's in an industrial-type setting, there may be some chemical residue in the air, that sort of thing. In addition, as I think the last caller observed, we're an aging society. Dryness is more common as we get older. In addition, when we read, we customarily are looking down, and so the lid covers a significant part of the cornea. When we use a computer, we're generally looking more or less straight ahead, so our eyes are open wider. There's more evaporation because the surface area is larger. So all of these things contribute to dryness. In addition, we tend not to blink as often, so our eyes tend to get scratchy, irritated, we get blurred vision. We may paradoxically get tearing because when the eye gets dry, it turns on reflex tearing that tries to improve the situation.
But now I just have to break in and say you've listed a number of things that can happen through computer use, but then you started by saying computers don't hurt your eyes. I'm confused a little bit here because all those things sound like they might be hurting my eyes.
Well, What I meant is you can certainly have eye symptoms, but they don't do damage to your eyes. Okay, in other words, if computers really did damage to our eyes, there probably would not be enough eye doctors to take care of everybody because everybody's on the computer all the time. So these things are annoyances, and we can address many of them through the use of supplemental tears. You know, before you start using a computer, use an artificial teardrop. See if you can work more comfortably for a longer period of time. Take breaks. At least 5 minutes every hour, you should look away from the computer screen. Get up and walk around. The ergonomics of your workstation are also important. Try to position the screen so that you don't get glare. The light in the room should be moderate. It shouldn't be too dim or too bright. If it's too dim, we tend to get glare. If it's too bright, we tend tends to wash out the screen.
Well, and that is an important question, because I think some people like to work on computers in complete darkness. Others like to have a balance of light. And you're saying what exactly? It's good to have a little bit of light coming from different places, or what about all the light coming right off that big, bright computer screen?
Well, I'm saying that if all the light comes off the computer screen, some people will find that difficult. In addition, remember that a computer distance for reading is different than when we're holding a book or a magazine. It tends to be a little bit further away, so it tends to be actually more of an intermediate distance. So, in fact, if you are wearing a bifocal, the bottom part is good for things that are like 14 inches away. Top part is good for things that are 6 feet away and more. And the computer screen is an intermediate distance. So you may need either a progressive that deals with all distances or a trifocal. Or if you spend a lot of time at the computer, sometimes a special pair of glasses for use at the computer is a good choice.
Well, and we do want to get to the special glasses for the computer in just a moment. You want to join us, 860-275-7266. Lots of different things to talk about. Let's go quickly to Chloe in Brantford. Hi there, Chloe. Go ahead. You're on Where We Live.
Hi, yeah. There's actually a Simpsons episode that is exactly like what you guys are talking about right now, where Lisa is trying to cut down on the light pollution in Springfield. And so they end up cutting out all the lights in the city, and then a crime spree ends up happening. And the whole city goes up in arms, and they end up relighting the city even brighter than it had ever been lit before. And I think that that's an interesting part of all of this, is I feel as though a lot of the lighting that we have, especially in urban settings, is because we're all so afraid that we're going to get attacked in the dark. And in all honesty, I'd like to have a little more faith in humanity that if we cut out more lights, that we wouldn't necessarily have to fear for our safety from one another.
Well, and Chloe, thank you. You know, Susan, I think from Plainfield has a similar thought. Susan, go ahead. You're on Where We Live. Susan, are you there? Oh, maybe we lost Susan. I think a lot of people are concerned about the safety aspect. I'll also say that there's another aspect of this about lighting up the city, Leo Smith. Many cities do almost what you'd call heroic lighting. I mean, we want to show that we are a massive, wonderful place. I mean, think of Times Square, think of Tokyo, think of cities doing light up nights in order to show themselves off for the national public. And this is something that, despite our need for energy conservation, despite all the things that you and Dr. Stevens have been talking about, people still engage in. A bright city is a vibrant city, a place that you want to be, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And there's nothing to say that Times Square shouldn't have lights. However, it is, in my opinion, absolutely insane that if you took a look at Times Square, you find that they have streetlights there. They don't need them. It's amazing.
I never noticed the streetlights, frankly.
Yeah, there are streetlights there.
You could probably light Times Square just by all the cell phones that all the tourists walking around have without anything else.
I make a comment regarding safety. You know, there's two parts to safety. One is what we'll call the statistical analysis that shows that safety actually relates to, let's say, more lighting. And the other is a psychological sense of safety that has really nothing to do with whether it is or isn't safe. It's just a question of the feel of safe. And the United States Department of Justice did a study one time with regards to lighting, and concluded that there's really no way to tell whether the light actually helps the people that live in the area or it helps the perpetrator. And a good example would be at the ATM machine, if it's all well lit, well, maybe that makes the person feel good, but it also would help the perpetrator determine that it's the 80-year-old lady at the ATM as opposed to the 6'5" football player. And that makes a determination on how the perpetrator assesses their chances for robbery.
There's a lot on safety. Let's move on to some other things here. We have a tweet here that says, I've fallen asleep working on a laptop in bed and gotten terrible sleep, never attributed to the light. I'll ask you first, Dr. Stevens, about this idea of working on a laptop just before sleep. What does it do to us?
Well, okay, so it would be best to get as dim as possible in the hours before sleep. Again, this is a personal preference and the things we need to do. Certainly, if you have the bedroom lights on or the lights in the rest of the house and then turn them off, you're not going to get to sleep right away, in part because it has delayed your what's called melatonin onset, which is a marker for the circadian system. For the laptop, again, this is an area we don't know enough about yet, how bright are those lights. But your mind being so active, and as was talked about before, what these computers do to people, it's got to make it more difficult to get to sleep.
Dr. Ehrlichs, maybe you can chime in. There's laptops, there's iPads, there's Kindles. Do any of these have any difference as far as what you do when you're reading them in the dark just before sleep?
Well, the brightness does make a difference. The type size, certainly, depending on the size of the screens you're using, is going to make a difference as well. And I think probably, you know, the smaller the screen, the smaller the typeface, the more you're going to feel a bit of eye strain from struggling to read that, particularly, you know, if you're over a certain age. In terms of the light source used in these devices, more are using LEDs now and fewer are using fluorescence as a source of light for the screen. Now, both fluorescence and LEDs tend to have a higher visibility in the blue spectrum than in the red spectrum. And the blue spectrum has been implicated by some studies as part of a cause of some degenerative change, and it's more difficult for our eyes to focus in the blue spectrum. Now, other studies have said it's not a cause of degenerative change. There's no evidence, you know, a 10 of 12 epidemiologic studies said it wasn't related. So probably a larger screen, larger font size, and if you want to change your color away from the blue end of the spectrum, that's probably not a bad idea.
So the blue end of the spectrum, potentially bad for degenerative eye disease, and also, Dr. Stevens, that's also the bad one as far as your circadian rhythms.
Yeah, there's no magic cutoff, but it's very clear from human experiments, very carefully done, that the spectrum is very important. Blue is the most effective at suppressing melatonin in the middle of the night, and in fact, it falls off to almost no effect in the far red, where you can still see vision, but it does not affect your circadian system.
We got an email from Dave who says, I discovered a program called Flux for the computer that overlays an orange filter over your computer screen to eliminate the blue rays at night. It slowly dims the screen as the sun sets. I know there's programs like this, Dr. Ehlers. There's also special glasses maybe you can use for the computer. Do they work?
Well, it depends on what the nature of the special glasses are. First of all, there's the refractive element, and that depends on your age and your underlying refractive error, what you need in terms of the ideal glasses to see at the appropriate distance for a screen. In terms of cutting out the blue end of the spectrum, some people choose to wear glasses with a light yellow tint, and that tends to cut out the blue end of the spectrum. It tends to make it a little bit easier for some people to focus. It tends to decrease glare for some people. Also, anti-reflective coatings tend to reduce glare for some people. So all of these things are helpful. There's no magic combination that works for everyone, but those various elements, the light yellow tint, anti-reflective coating, are helpful.
And just very, very quickly, because we're almost out of time, because there's no magic bullet for anyone, I mean, can you be fitted for the right pair of glasses like you'd be fitted for a prescription for reading?
Yes, I think that you can specify the tint and anti-reflective coating and those elements that make it more usable.
I want to thank Dr. William Ehlers, an ophthalmologist at the University of Connecticut, for joining us. Thank you very much, sir, for being here.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And I also want to thank our other guest, Dr. Richard Stevens, an epidemiologist from the University of Connecticut Health Center. Good to see you once again, and really interesting stuff, as always. Thank you again for your time.
Thank you, John, very much.
And thanks to Leo Smith, the Northeast Regional Director for the International Dark Sky Association. Thank you, Leo, for being here very much. Happy stargazing to you.
Thank you, John.
Betsy Kaplan produced our show today. Thanks, as always, to Heather Brand. And Tucker Ives is the producer of Where We Live. I want to thank our interns, John Galliani, Chelsea Edgar, John Healy, and Lydia Brown. Katie Talarski is the senior producer of Where We Live. Don't forget that on Tuesday of next week, it's primary night. We'll be broadcasting live from the Red Rock in downtown Hartford. Me and Colin McEnroe with a night full of primary coverage. You can join me tonight at Litchfield Jazz Festival. Go to litchfieldjazzfest.com to find out more. I'm John Dankosky, and this is Where We Live.